Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. In this episode, my guest is Jeff Lowenfels, co-author, along with Wayne Lewis, of Teeming with Microbes, the Organic Gardener's Guide to the Soil Food Web, which recently released a revised edition. He was recommended as a guest by Dr. Doug Tallamy, author of Bringing Nature Home. Located in Alaska, Jeff writes a weekly gardening column for the Anchorage Daily News and has not missed a single week in more than 30 years. This makes him, according to the Garden Writers Association, the longest-running garden columnist in the United States. With over 1,500 articles without a hitch, imagine my surprise when I found out that gardening is only his avocation. His career was as a lawyer. I can only imagine the number of jokes he must have gotten about being a dirty lawyer with all the gardening that he does. His work for us, however, is important because whether you are a gardener, farmer, attorney, or permaculturist, if you work with the earth, you need to have an understanding of the soil food web and the interactions and interrelationships of the life in the soil. Building soil builds life. Destroying the life in the soil destroys the soil, and therefore life. We spend our time together discussing the importance of supporting this system, continually marveling at its productivity and efficiency, starting with the smallest members, the bacteria, archaea, and fungi. We need to support this system, and the best way that we can do that is through organic processes that are fairly simple and straightforward, mulching, composting, and the application of compost teas. They're easy and the best way to go. If you would like to learn more about the soil, I highly recommend Jeff's book, Teeming with Microbes. It's now a part of my standard permaculture library and is something I'll be referring to when discussing soils with others or developing teaching materials about soil. If you have questions or comments that arise from this episode, contact me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or at the voicemail line, 717-827-6266. I hope you enjoy this time with Jeff as much as I did. Now on to the interview.
To get us started with a little bit about your background.
I grew up in New York in a very ritzy community, but I grew up on a farm situation in a sense. My father was a gentleman farmer, which means he would come home from work every day and put on his old shoes and go out and garden. And so we grew a lot of our own food, and we were very, very into gardening. We had a gigantic orchard, acres of vegetables, et cetera, and, you know, one of these families where the water had to be boiling before the corn was picked, that kind of stuff. And my father was very organic, except for one thing. He used Miracle-Gro. And the reason why he used Miracle-Gro is because his company employed a young man right out of his grad school in advertising, and this young man had to take care of the business of advertising butter, which is what my father sold. And the young man hated the job so much that he ended up, long story very, very short, founding Miracle-Gro. And so my father and Miracle-Gro had a very tight connection. Miracle-Gro, as you know, has gone on to be Scotts Miracle-Gro, and they are a gigantic chemical company. And my father was a big user, and I was a big user. And I used to argue with fellow garden writers about the use of chemicals. And my argument was that it didn't make a difference to a plant whether the nitrogen came from a brown manure or a green powder. It was nitrogen. And so it didn't make a bit of difference. And if anybody could explain to me why it really made a big difference, you know, I'd stop using Miracle-Gro and I'd become a gigantic organic proponent. And I'd have this argument every year. Nobody would ever be able to solve the argument to my satisfaction. And until one day about 1996, a friend of mine sent me a picture of a electron microscope picture of a nematode being strangled by a fungal hyphae that was literally protecting a tomato root from nematode attacks. It blew my mind. I had no idea what I was looking at. I finally figured it out using the internet. And then I noticed that he'd written some words called the soil food web. And I couldn't figure out what that meant. And I dug through the internet again. This is back in 1996. And I found Dr. Elaine Ingham's diagram of the soil food web. And it had all of these relationships and words and terms that as at the time, a 20, 25-year garden writer, I shouldn't have known about. And I didn't. And so I spent a tremendous amount of time studying the soil food web, trying to figure out what my friend was trying to tell me. And it became quickly very evident why it makes a difference between organic and chemical. And that led to a series of philosophical changes that led to, and I'm a garden writer, as you may know, that write a garden column in the Anchorage Daily News, and that caused me to change my column attitude and the way I practiced the hobby of gardening. And eventually, it led to serious discussions among fellow garden writers about the soil food web, our lack of knowledge about the soil food web, real soul searching, and then a book. So here we are today talking about the soft food web as a result of a bet that somebody couldn't show me that nitrogen did make a difference if it came from a brown manure versus a green powder.
Is that a bet that you're kind of happy that you lost?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just incredible. And just, you know, obviously I think your listeners understand, but use chemicals, you end up destroying the soil food web. We'll be talking, I'm sure, about what that is, but organics, you support the soil food web. That's the ultimate answer at the end of the show. That'll be the take-home message. That was the ultimate discovery. The soil food web itself, of course, is something that anybody who practices permaculture, gardening, needs to understand, because if you don't understand the soil food web, then you don't understand what's supposed to be happening in the soil between plants, the soil, and the community that's in the soil.
And from reading your book, one of the things that stood out to me is how much of the soil food web and the life that's there exists on the microscopic level, that it's things that we don't see. It's one thing to go out in the garden and see that you have a mold or a vole digging around, or perhaps you see some insects on the surface and spiders. But like when you talk about bacteria and fungi, in most cases, we never see any result of that, except for maybe every once in a while we see a mushroom,
right,
not realizing that that's the fruiting body of the actual fungus in the soil.
Right, right, right. I mean, it's just the numbers are staggering. So for the bacteria, and we have to add that it's not just bacteria. It turns out that in 1976 or 1978, somebody was fooling around with the bacteria and noticed that the kind of bacteria they were fooling around with had a different kind of cell wall than the regular bacteria, and discovered a new form of life. Well, it's actually an ancient form of life, but the third branch of life, plants, bacteria, and archaea. Archaea, A-R-C-H-A-E-A, I can't spell it, but anyway, they look just like bacteria, but they're completely different. They have a different cellular structure. They are different organisms, but in any case, in a teaspoon of soil, there are, anywhere from some 600 million to a billion bacteria and archaea. Some people would say a trillion, but let's stop at a billion. It's unbelievable. The numbers are phenomenal. That's in a teaspoon of soil. And fungi, there are 14 feet of invisible fungal hyphae in a teaspoon of good soil. And these things are there for real reasons in terms of our activities. And it all starts with the plants, which is the most amazing thing. And I think you and I probably take home and ponder about more than anything else. You know, plants, because they don't move, have to deal with an incredible range of activities. It seems to us that plants are an inferior, lesser organism. But what we don't understand, most of us, is how they operate and what's really going on. And it's an amazing thing. So go into that real quick. What happens is plants in photosynthesis produce energy. And about 50 to 70% of the energy doesn't go into making the tomato or the leaves or the flowers. It goes into making things that drip out of the roots called exudates. And exudates are designed specifically by the plant, specific bacteria, and specific fungi. And they live in the rhizosphere, the area right next to the roots, eating these exudates. And they, in turn, attract protozoa, things we studied in high school, amoebas and paramecians, and nematodes, which are true worms, but hair size or smaller, microscopic. And these eat the bacteria and the fungi, and they eat them for carbon and some of the little bits of the other stuff, but basically the carbon, and they excrete the excess. The excess contains nitrogen in plant-usable form. Plant takes that nitrogen up. It has this little factory system going on right in its rhizosphere because it puts these exudates out in the soil. And if it wants a different mix of bacteria and fungi, it changes the exudate. It can bring in different kinds of bacteria and fungi. Absolutely spectacular. So the plant is in control of the system. And the bacteria and fungi attract the protozoa and the nematodes. The protozoa and the nematodes attract worms and microarthropods and all sorts of things. And all of these things are not only working ultimately to make this material, nitrogen and goodies, available to the plant, but they're also making structure in the soil so that the plant can live in the best possible environment. And it's a beautiful, beautiful system.
One of the things that stood out that I remembered, because just the way the analogy came across, was the idea that the plant is the factory producing the exudates, but then your fungi and archaea and bacteria are the fertilizer bags, and then your nematodes and protozoa come in and they're your fertilizer spreaders.
Right, right, exactly. And it works just that way because that's how plants feed themselves. They feed themselves. Now, they do one other thing with these exudates. They attract very specific fungi called mycorrhizal. And mycorrhizal fungi are one of these unbelievable things that exist in the world that most people have absolutely no idea about. And what's worse, most gardeners, up until at least 4 or 5 years ago, have never heard of. Mycorrhizal fungi are these very special fungi that in return for these exudates, they go out and bring back to the plant all sorts of things, particularly phosphorus, which is tied up in the soil and very, very difficult for a plant to get on its own. Nitrogen, copper, all of the metals they bring, they're unbelievable. And water, they bring them all back to the plant in return for these exudates. And if they don't bring things back, they don't live. It's fascinating. This system that's underground there just all came together in the 90s. Combination of electron microscopy, soil science, chemistry, biology, cellular biology, and it all converged around the plant-soil microorganism relationship. And in fact, I would venture to guess some people would say that this is where permaculture came from. You know, this is the ultimate getting along, mixing of different systems and having them all work like finely tuned gears, because that's what happens in the soil. It's a beautiful, beautiful system. Everything that's in the soil plays a role in helping that plant grow. It's absolutely spectacular. Absolutely spectacular. But I could go on forever.
And your book is a great place for anybody if they would like the, if you will, short version of all of this in one way to sit down and take all of it in. I know that the first time that I ran across mycorrhizal fungi was only a couple years ago through the work of Paul Stamets. But since then, I've looked into the work of Dr. Elaine Ingham. You're probably the third or fourth person I've spoken to. She keeps coming up as someone to talk to about soil.
Oh, not just about soil, but about microbiology in the soil is, well, I can't say enough good things about her. She's a wonderful, wonderful scientist. As far as I am concerned, she is the guru of the soil food web movement, and she's got a lot to teach the world, I got to tell you, and does quite a bit of that. She's a terrific, terrific asset. What she's explained about the soil food web is such an eye-opener. And again, we indicated, before the mic went on, every day I read something in Science News that I learned from Elaine Ingham 10 years ago. It's absolutely fascinating. She's terrific, and she's over at Riverdale Institute now, and she's the chief scientist there, and she's going to do some phenomenal. If you ever have an opportunity to go here, you should, because she suffers no fools. She is a scientist.
Well, I'm fortunate enough that I live not too far from Rodale. They're within driving distance of where I am here in Pennsylvania. Hoping to go out and see her, but also if anyone else is interested, I'll include some links in the show notes to Dr. Elaine Ingham so you can look up her information with Rodale. She's constantly offering classes both at Rodale and elsewhere, at least in the United States, that people can get a chance to go see her.
It's one of the things that has been operating in the book I always indicate, and in my talks I always indicate, you know, whoever put Miracle-Gro on the redwoods? Who had to ever spray them for aphids? The system works by itself. What happens is we come along. And we're part of the soil food web, too. Unfortunately, we're not beneficial as worms and, you know, even slugs. I mean, everything has this little role. Even the birds that fly have a role in the soil food web. They touch the ground and they deposit protozoa, their taxi cabs. We come along and we figure, well, no, the plant's not in control. We're in control. We're growing the plants. And so we use chemicals because we've been told that they're going to work better. They're going to grow things. We've seen the commercials. We've seen the ads. And sure, they work. They do a great job. But if you read the label on these chemicals, they say you got to apply them every 2 or 3 weeks. The reason you have to apply them every 2 or 3 weeks is because you have killed off, or you have destroyed, in terms of moving them off, the soil food web that would normally feed the plant itself. And it happens in many, many different ways, starting with just the nitrogen aspect alone. Nitrogen is the key element that plants require, and they don't get it, they don't do well. We come along and give them nitrogen with these chemical fertilizers, and they get it too easy. So they don't need nitrogen-fixing bacteria anymore. So they don't adjust the pH of the soil so nitrogen-fixing bacteria live there. And so there aren't any nitrogen-fixing bacteria there. And when you stop giving them nitrogen, uh-oh. The mycorrhizal fungi, if you give the plant phosphorus, which is, you know, NPK, those three numbers on your fertilizer, if you give your plant phosphorus over number 10 or 12 at the very most, if you give it phosphorus, the mycorrhizal fungi aren't needed because there's enough phosphorus for the root to come into direct contact with during a short growing season or an annual growing season, for example. And lo and behold, the mycorrhizal fungi disappear. Well, if they're not there when they're needed, they're not there. So it's a serious problem. We alter it. And then we start to lose soil structure because all of these things, worms, for example, make tunnels. They make burrows. They pull in organic material, microarthropods, even those slugs I talked about. For everyone you see above ground eating a leaf, there's five or six of them down below the ground in the soil, breaking down dead material and more available for those bacteria and the protozoa and the nematodes. And it's just, and we come along and we put down a chemical that they don't like. Worms don't like the smell of Miracle-Gro and they go away. And if you don't have them, then you're not pulling organic material down. The whole system caves in when we step forward and try to override what has been developed over a million years. It's just simply an incredible, incredible system.
You talk about feeding them fertilizer and having to apply it over and over again. Here in central Pennsylvania, there's a farming newspaper, very popular on the East Coast, and they've done some reports in there that I've gotten to see about some of the farms that are doing research tests with organic versus chemical fertilizing. And one of the things that they showed was just the root mass that's occurring with their plants when they're going organic versus feeding them chemical, because the chemicals, as they wash away, the roots may follow them so far, but they're not getting that really deep, full penetration, so they don't have as much access to water. And then, as you were saying, the mycorrhizal fungi that are building the support structure with the plant can bring them all this nutrients and water and everything, even as the root mass gets larger and larger, gives them so much more area to pull from as opposed to these chemically fed plants with their small root structures. And I think about the impact that drought is occurring because of the use of chemicals.
The mycorrhizal fungi alone, in terms of what they do in terms of bringing in water to the plant, but they do something else. This root mass, first of all, the root mass itself contains tremendous amounts of carbon, and not all of that root mass is harvested. And so carbon is left in the soil. But more important, the mycorrhizal fungi produce 33% of the carbon that's in the soil. And if you've killed off that mycorrhizal fungi, forget the fact that your plant is now dependent on you. The following year, you don't have that 33%. You don't have the carbon growth that you get from the mycorrhizal fungi. They convert the energy from these exudates, from the sun that ends up into these exudates, or ends up in stuff that they decay, break down, they convert it into carbon. It's unbelievable. It's a serious, serious problem. And people had no idea what was going on because they never even heard of mycorrhizal fungi. Now, here's the shocking fact. Eat 96% of every single plant on the planet Earth have this relationship. And until 1996, I know not one gardener who wrote gardening columns, books, or magazines in the United States of America had any idea that a mycorrhizal fungi existed, because I asked 960 of them at a meeting, and not one raised their hand. They'd never heard of a mycorrhizal fungi. 96% of the plants! That's almost like not ever hearing the fact that we require oxygen to live on. And so we come along unknowingly and destroy that mycorrhizal fungi network. It forms a network under your system. If you have a yard, there is a mycorrhizal subway system under there that is unreal. It's a Milky Way of invisible fungal hyphae. If you take a rye grass, just a piece of rye grass, that teaspoon of soil, which would normally have 14 feet of mycorrhizal fungi, has 3 miles of mycorrhizal fungi in it. A teaspoon of soil. So it makes a difference. And we come along with chemicals, and sure, we can say, sure, yeah, we can feed the world with chemicals, but we destroy the soil, we run out of chemicals. As we're running out of phosphate, we are now almost at peak phosphorus, which means that we are in a fast decline. In our lifetime, Scott, we're going to run out of phosphorus. That's a pretty scary thing when you consider that it's an essential element. Not only that, but it's a macro element. What are we going to do? It's a fascinating question. All of this relates to the soil food web, of course, and we come along and we have a tendency not to treat the soil web well. We've got to learn how to deal with it, and we can't do that until we learn what it is. And thank goodness for people like Dr. Elaine for spreading the word, really, at great peril, I'd add, because there's a lot of people who disagreed with the message.
Because it went in the face of what we now consider conventional agriculture, or were there other issues that she encountered?
Well, that was clearly the main one. I mean, my goodness, anybody who works for a university is getting paid by a major chemical company that does work for the ag industry. You know, it's an incredible world we have out here. So there's a great deal of opposition to organics. Constantly hear that organics can't feed the world. that there's no difference in nutrition, et cetera, none of which I think, neither of which are true, disturbing to people. I mean, there are, as we know, multinational billion-trillion-dollar companies that rely on a practice that does not support the soil food web.
I imagine in the face of that, with a lot of the information that comes out about organic gardening and your work about spreading mulch, make sure that you use a good, healthy compost that you can make yourself from your own on-farm or in-home materials, I can see where there would be that resistance.
Well, there is a lot of resistance to it. I mean, you know, if you were a large fertilizer company and you wanted to sell fertilizer, you don't want people making their own. And that's an unfortunate thing, because really there's plenty of room for fertilizer. The largest fertilizer company in the country, Scotts Miracle-Gro, makes a chemical fertilizer, no question about it. And as I indicated, it works. There's no question about that either. But what people don't also realize is that they're also the largest purveyor of organic fertilizers in the country. So there's money to be made on both sides of the fence. And I just hope that we push them to the point where that's what they want to do, is make money selling organic fertilizers. And really, anybody who uses a chemical fertilizer has to ask themselves whether they want to work as hard as they are working, because that's what happens. The name of the book is Teaming with Microbes, T-E-A-M. And the reason why we are teaming with the microbes is because they do the work. They feed the plant. You're not fertilizing the plant. You're feeding the microbes. They're feeding the plant. They create the soil structure that the plant enjoys. They help the plant get water. You're teaming with these guys that do work while they take care of the plant and take care of themselves. It's just, again, as I indicate, every time I get an opportunity, it is a gorgeous system that we really need to learn about so that we don't destroy it.
Going through the material that you present, combined with some of the other stuff out there, it's just that initial input to get everything working, to do the research, the planning, if you will, the design of your garden, to know what's my soil like here, what's my soil like there, doing the census of the creatures that are living in the soil, finding out what's a little acidic, what's a little alkaline, bringing that all together, applying the rules that you have, and then making it easier year after year.
Yeah, again, it's so easy to do. There are three basic ways that you make soil. All of them require adding stuff to the soil itself. It's something called the law of return in agriculture. And basically what it says is if you take something off of the property that was going to supply nutrients to the plant, then you've got to supply the plant with those nutrients. That makes sense, doesn't it? And as gardeners and as farmers, we harvest. We take stuff out of the garden, off the farm. And all of that stuff would have normally rotted, would have fed the soil food web system. It would have returned back to the soil and gone back through a cycle and gone back into the plant. Very nice, beautiful system. By nature, we need to eat. We need to take some of that. We need to break that law of return. Then we need to amend and go back and replace what we took off the land. So you can do that by putting on mulches. You can do that by putting on compost. You can do that by putting on organics, or I guess there's really five ways. You can also add the mycorrhizal fungi if they've been killed off, and you can add compost tea, which we believe adds lots of microbiology to the soil. Of all five of those, the last one is the only real controversial one. Only really controversial because it's very hard to duplicate different soil conditions around the block, for that matter.
Compost tea was the one question that I was going to have for you, because that's, as you say, that's the one that's controversial. One of the gardening websites that I like to read from time to time is the one from, it's Washington State University, Linda Chalker Scott and her crew.
Yeah, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott and Dr. Jeff Gillum.
Yes. And the one of the articles that they have out there is on compost tea, because I think there are only like 8 actual studies that have ever been done on it. Some show that it does work, some show that it doesn't.
Both of them are my friends. And we've discussed it. Let's start it this way. Do I use compost tea? Absolutely. Does Harvard University compost tea in this entire system? Absolutely. Does New York Botanical Garden use compost tea? Absolutely. Does it work? Absolutely. Does Morton Arbor Redom use it? Absolutely. Did they do a study? Absolutely. Was it reviewed by Dr. Lynch? I don't think so. You know, there were lots of studies, and I see many of them. I understand where Dr. Linda Chalker Scott is coming from. There are darn few real long-term studies on compost tea. This is one of the things that Dr. Lean's doing down in Rodale. So we see the studies. And again, I asked people to go look at the Morton Arboretum study. I've seen several studies out of the University of Hawaii. I saw a beautiful study out of the University of Arizona. Absolutely spectacular study out of the University of Arizona. I don't know what the story is there. I just don't. I use it. I'm a big believer. And I urge people to do it. I do agree with two things, however. One is, if you're going to be using manure, you better darn sure make sure you know how to make compost tea. It's got to be aerated. Otherwise, you run the risk of E. coli. I think that's very, very important. And I don't use manures when I make compost, frankly. I'm a little bit worried about whether they're antibiotics that don't break down in the compost pile. I worry about E. coli, frankly. So I don't use manures. It's very simple. The reason why people use manures in compost traditionally was because we had animals. Today, you know, other than the dog or a cat, we really don't, as a general rule. So it's not one of those things you need for compost. The second thing, of course, that's a little bit controversial, although getting to be much less so, is the mycorrhizal fungi. And I say that for this reason. The mycorrhizal fungi is ubiquitous. If you've not disturbed the soil food web system, the mycorrhizal fungi exists in your system. It's when you disturb it that you lose it. It's when you use compost, which doesn't have mycorrhizal fungi in it, to start your plants like we do here in Alaska and move them out to be transplanted outdoors. We add the mycorrhizal fungi when we start the plant so that it immediately has it rather than wait 6 to 8 weeks before we get it outside for it to establish a relationship with these fungi. So there was a period of time where people were saying, no, mycorrhizal fungi, you do not need to add them to anything. This has fallen by the wayside for sure. There are unbelievable studies on the use of mycorrhizal fungi in existing situations. Unreal differences. More nodules in soybeans, more nitrogen fixing, just phenomenal stuff. I urge the listener to just type in mycorrhizal fungi and see what's out there. It is incredible.
I'll certainly include some links for folks to additional information and some places where they can go check out what the different varieties are. My local gardening center sells several different types. It's in their organic fertilizer section, and it's a very reasonable and goes a pretty long way when you...
Just to the listener, that also, they take a look at a special website. About 90% of the mycorrhizal fungi, it comes from one company, and their website is www.mycorrhizae, the Latin mycorrhizae, mycorrhizae.com. They have a phenomenal website. You type in the name of your plant, and it'll tell you the kind of mycorrhizal fungi that it's associated.
While we're on the topic of mycorrhizal fungi, did your book reference a story? Was it Haiti and trying to grow?
Puerto Rico. Yeah, I think it's in the book. It's been so long since I read it. in Puerto Rico, they couldn't grow ever. They would start to grow and they would turn yellow after about the first year and then they would die off. After 2 or 3 years, they'd be completely gone. Sometime in the 1950s, somebody brought down evergreens in soil that had the mycorrhizal fungi in it. And those particular evergreens lived, and they were surprised, and now there's evergreens all over Puerto Rico. We have a similar situation here in Alaska. We do not have maple trees here. We do not have maple trees. About 25 years ago, Sears Roebuck brought in about 10 maple trees in soil. Most of the things that get shipped here, because we're far away, end up being soilless because it's lighter. And so they ship this particular 10 or so plants out in soil, in pots. Those plants actually produce maples that are alive today, big ones, throwing off seedlings that grow in that little area. And we've discovered it's the mycorrhizal fungi. If you take a little bit of the soil, when you pick up these transplants, bingo, you get a maple tree. Amazing thing. Now, is that good or bad? We are just beginning to have that debate because of the impact it might have, not only on the soil food web, but on the above ground web as well, the atmosphere food web, so to speak. So it's fascinating, but it's the mycorrhizal fungi that makes a difference.
Your book was where that story came from. I read one today that was about clear cutting in Oregon. I believe it's the Douglas fir. Even though they have saplings in place, they're finding out now that the mycorrhizal fungi that's required, it's usually processed because of the squirrels. They'll wind up carrying that in their gut flora. And then as they live in the trees and then, of course, poop that out on the soil, then that spreads it around. And now as they've clear cut and the squirrels have moved out, they've disturbed the soil, destroyed the mycorrhizal fungi, and they don't know if they're going to be able to replant Douglas firs on that ground.
Yeah, the connection is phenomenal. And I think, it's just a very phenomenal thing that people need to be aware of. And intuitively, we are. I think intellectually, we're not. And that was one of the things that I wasn't certain wrote the book. It really caused me to sit down and think about some of these things in a way that we're not accustomed to. I had to really think in terms of scientific terms, and it was fun. It was really a lot of fun. So I hope people do read the book. I hope they get the same sense of enthrallment and fascination of this system that we know little teeny things about. And we barely know how to identify things we see in the soil. You know, when we see a bird, many of us know exactly what that is. We're birders. We have binoculars. When we see things in the soil, either the tendency is to ignore it, to flinch, or maybe just to go away. And there's a wonderful book out by a guy named James Nardi, N-A-R-D-I, and I think he would be kind of fun. I've never met him. Emailed together, and I'm certainly a big fan of his book, called Life in the Soil. In a sense, it's an identification book for things that you find when you're looking at the soil food. And I highly recommend people get that book as they start to pay attention. What's happening in the soils that they walk on and that they garden in and, you know, that they're around. I think they'd be fascinated by it. It's fun to be able to give a name to things and then to look them up and to know what they do and how they do it. Little pill bugs, for example, these are true crustaceans. They are throwbacks from the oceans. They have to circulate their urine inside their system, right underneath their little shell. They circulate their urine to simulate that ocean environment. How many millions of, you know, hundreds of thousands of years since they were there? Wow, unbelievable. To know that they eat little teeny bits of copper. They eat their own dung because it contains copper. They need copper in their system. So when you see them around your plants, they're getting that little micronutrient that they need. There's copper around there. Just the whole system fits. Love it.
Amazing and so stunning that it's right there outside our door every day, and we just don't know about it. The information that you provide breaks it down in a way that's very understandable. And the what we can do to support it is so simple. We just have to be aware of the fact that this is what we need to do.
So simple. You're absolutely right. And it's not hard work. That's the amazing thing. For example, as a gardener, I used to love to rototill, but it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. When you pick up teeming with microbes, one of the first things you learn is, no rototilling. That's not good. Once you do it, that's the last time ever. You know, you go, wow, I just saved myself a lot of work. One thing after another, just like that. I never weed anymore. I have mulch, takes care of it. I don't have to weed. I haven't taken my hose out once this year, except in my greenhouse where I have tomatoes. Not once. It's the first time ever. Things are just operating by themselves. In fact, my wife says, gee, why don't you go out in the garden? So I had to invent. That's what happens when you team with microbes.
It's great material, and I'm really happy that you've written this book and that you were recommended to me by Dr. Tallamy, because I don't know when I would have found it. And the material is just, it's great. I really, really like everything you put there. It's an easy read. It's not like reading a textbook, though it is, as I've said before we started the interview, it is a little heavy at points. If you're not familiar with the material, and just because of how big the soil food web really is, from bacteria and fungi and archaea all the way up.
But I think I did make a promise in there that I would repeat myself enough times so that by the time you put the book down, you wouldn't even have to go back and look stuff up.
It's one of those things that comes from teaching. Is there's the idea of circular learning, that you keep coming back to something. I think it's something like 6 times. But I sitting here now, even though I just finished the book a couple of days ago, and all of that material still makes sense because I can follow it the way that it was laid out from the small to the large and through your rules. It's now a part of my gardening consciousness.
Well, that's great. That's what it was supposed to do. I appreciate that. You made my month.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm certainly looking forward to the next book, right on how we can team with the soil.
I've already written it. It's at the publishers, and Teaming with Nutrients, the Organic Gardener's Guide to Plant Nutrition, will be out in May.
May of 2013.
Right. Well, have another show if you like it.
Well, I'll certainly put it on my calendar to keep an eye out for it.
All right.
Thank you so much for everything that we've covered today. Is there anything else that you'd like to add? We have the takeaway that we need to support the soil food web as the big lesson for the episode, but is there anything else you'd like to add to our interview?
Well, you know, I think since you've mentioned Doug, and since I know you're a permaculturist, and I just wrote a column in my daily news column, and I think we're on a stage now where gardeners have to have discussions that you seem to be fostering about how we are doing things and how they relate to the soil food web. Now, you know, Dr. Doug, his food web is above the soil level. Mine's below the soil level. And I think together he and I present a picture that everybody has to take a look at. How are we impacting these two food webs? How are they being impacted by things that we as gardeners and people who love plants do? That's a take home that we all have to be thinking about and discussing. As we noted, gardeners are polite people who are intellectual and who seem to get along. And so I think this is the discussion that we need to have, and we need to have a hard one about it in terms of natives, invasives, and what their impacts are on the wildlife and all of the permaculture stuff that we talk about impacting. We are permaculturists, all of us. And everything we do impacts everything else. And so we have to discuss that amongst ourselves.
Well, as you continue to write your column and spread your word and do your part, I'll continue to do mine. And we'll get this information out there.
I like it. I like it a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for another interview. If you have comments or questions about this or any other episode, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leave a message or send me an email. That address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Until the next time, take care of yourself, the earth, and each other.